Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, John Zombro, and I'm here with, actually, before I even tell you that, I think I should tell you a little story. So, growing up as a little kid in the late 60s, early 70s, one of my favorite things to do in the afternoons was watch the Batman show. And it was just awesome because they had those special effects, and, you know, they would be like, they're fighting the bad guys, and it would be like biff, bam, kapow, and it would actually show the words and like a little thing that opened up on the screen. And that was high tech at the time. So I'm here with the guy who, because of his name, he's not kapow when he hits you with his awesomeness. He's pakow. It's PK.
Jay-Z. Interesting. That's a little childhood nugget right there. Especially, it's funny to think of those graphics on the screen with a little slapping or punching sound as special effects, but that must have been riveting.
Yeah, it's like when you walk into a room, it's just like
too kind as always. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And guys, audience members, listeners, thank you for being here as well. As you know, this Lifetime Athlete Podcast and journey is where we're all trying to achieve peak performance, really at any age, maintain our health in the process. And we do it by manipulating our lifestyle factors, our training, our recovery, our nutrition. And we're going to sort of get into some of that today in episode number 111, which is entitled Metabolic Flexibility for Athletes.
Absolutely. And John, how did this topic come up today? What's going on in your life that sort of raises this to the surface of your consciousness?
You know, I live an existence that hovers between control and serendipity.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, sometimes that's probably the best answer, but I have a list. It's a cue list of ideas for show episodes. And it literally, honestly, it numbers in the hundreds, as you know. And I was like, man, there's so many great topics and subtopics that either I want to share with folks or people have asked for specifically. And so I didn't have this one up exactly. But a few people had asked me, hey, you know, I've heard this term metabolic flexibility. What's it mean? And we've had that explanation or that discussion. And then also spring's around the corner somewhere, maybe not here in Montana at this time. But a lot of people are starting to tune up. You know, they're tuning up their training, and they're also taking a look at diet or nutrition or food. And so the topic today is, you know, not necessarily using like diet as that kind of word that's a verb that says, you know, it's all geared towards weight loss. Very generically, we're using diet as a noun in a way to make the metabolism more flexible to enhance athletic performance.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. And I think it is, even though we look out our windows here in Southwest Montana and see snow, fresh snow even, it really is the time of year when you're looking around the corner at spring and even into summer. I mean, I don't know. I have no idea why, but I've been watching some mountain biking videos recently. I mean, it's in the middle of winter, but I think that that's kind of a natural inclination to look around the corner and get excited for what's fresh. So I think your timing is perfect.
Well, thank you. And, you know, the days are getting longer. We're feeling it. I've also been gorging on indoor track.
Yeah. Have you really?
I have.
All the indoor track that you can muster, just a feast for your eyes, if you will.
Yeah. You know, getting in there, because this is an Olympic year. So obviously things are going to be heading outdoors. And, you know, it's good to see, well, you know, who's participating in the indoor season, what kind of form they're in across the different events. And, you know, kind of as a fan, you know, it's important to know your, be a student of your sport. And so that's kind of good. It's kind of good, nice psych up. And I'm, you know, gelling on what might eventually I'll figure out what my goal for the year is for myself in terms of performance. And that it'll probably be on the track, just because that's where I can perform on the high side of mediocre compared to some other areas. But nonetheless, getting me on task, you know. You know, you would ask, or I'll just say, I'll ask, what is metabolic flexibility?
Yeah, I mean, that is the question. If we're going to have this discussion, we need to start there.
Yeah. So it's really, metabolic flexibility is really the ability, the optimal ability to maximize energy extraction from either of the macronutrients that are our fuel sources.
We'll break that down a little bit for me.
Okay. So if we go into, I don't know what we're going to call this one, nutritional biochem sub 101, we're going to say that everyone probably recognizes the three macronutrients or macros as fat, protein, and carbohydrate, which can be presented in any order. And we've danced around and on different nuances this topic on the show multiple times, but this is a fun way to look at it today with this metabolic flexibility question or topic. Well, of course we've got fat, and fat is kind of a what you would call a dual purpose macro. It is both a building block for our parts of our brains, our nervous tissue, hormones, cell membranes, as well as a fuel. When we use fat for fuel in certain metabolic circumstances, then we've got protein, which is primarily designed to be a building block from which we build muscle, skin, hair, nails, bone, organs. That's what we use protein for. And then we've got carbohydrate or carbs, which really convert to, upon ingestion, to glucose eventually. Some exceptions there. And we use that as fuel, almost like jet fuel. So that's really what the macros are. But then if we said, well, okay, the fuel-based macros, which are fat and carbohydrate, there is a way to make sure that the athletic body is getting all that it can from those sources, as opposed to following a fairly monastic diet, which might actually not be as ideal for the athlete.
Ah, okay, I see. Okay, so this is interesting. So of the three macros, we get our energy from the fat and the carbohydrate. So in the context of this conversation, metabolic flexibility is the ability to get energy from either of those, not primarily one or the other for an athlete.
Yeah, precisely. And so that's really the trick, I think, with this topic. You know, when we're looking at the athlete, we want to always preserve health, and we can do that, but we can also make sure that this human beast is a dual fuel mechanism.
Hey. Yeah, and I think it's implied there, right? That like get energy for better performance, better power, better whatever your pursuit is as an athlete, in addition to overall wellness.
Yeah, and I would probably go down further this line of thought by saying, well, when we're talking about the lifetime athlete, we're talking about a person who already is healthy, and we just want to keep them healthy. And now we're really looking at how to tweak the levers and dials for peak performance. That right. is different than a person who is ill, obese, diabetic, and they got to dig out of the hole. That's a different dietary life-saving perspective. So we're not really talking about that today. And I just want to make sure that, listening confuses the two. I don't think they would.
Got it. Okay. So you've got a, relatively stable foundation nutritionally or metabolically, and then you really want to look at like pulling the best out of the energy sources. So talk to me a little bit more about we're setting the table here, if you will, for this metabolic flexibility.
Yeah. So from an athletic perspective, first example would be if a person chooses to eat a very high carb diet, a chronically high carbohydrate diet, particularly one that includes quite a bit of processed carbohydrates, that actually leads to a condition known in the literature as carbohydrate dependency. Mm. And again, I think we've touched on this before, but it's also called sugar burning. But the whole idea would be the body gets very used to knowing or learning that carbs are always coming in. They're munching down muffins, bread, pasta, cereal, fruit, whatever, every couple hours. So that's really all I need to burn. And so what happens is there is sort of a suppression of the ability to burn fat for fuel, whether that's ingested dietary fat or even the ability to access stored body fat. So if you eat nothing but carbs or high amounts for a prolonged time, you will suppress your ability to use fat for fuel, and you'll be very dependent on getting those carbs in. In fact, when you don't, that's known as the bonk, and it's pretty nasty.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that makes sense. I think that that idea is at least out there enough that we can absorb that concept pretty easily.
Yeah. And then if we said, well, on the other hand, which has been very popular, let's say we eat a very high fat or carbohydrate restricted diet, like a ketogenic diet, and there's different variations of that. Well, ultimately over time, that really has been shown to be helpful for weight management and for a lot of health issues, at least when it's done intermittently. However, a high fat diet will tend to downregulate the ability to use glucose for fuel, and those glucose insulin responses get a bit sluggish.
Interesting. See, I think that's a little less explored idea in this nutritional discussion, is that, the flip side of that, I guess the fervor around the side of high fat diet doesn't leave the nuances as, I guess, available to be explored, it feels like to me.
Yeah. I think that we want to always try to think about things through the ancestral lens, and whether you want to argue, is the human a preferential carnivore, or are we an opportunistic or obligate omnivore? That's not the debate for today, but the flexible beast, the metabolically flexible beast, can flip the switch and get the most out of either. And that's what we want for our athletic population. We don't want you to be sort of only able to use one form of fuel, because that may slightly impair performance in training and or competition.
Yeah, limits the upside. Okay, so let's get into that. Why is it important then, specifically for athletes?
Well, I think first of all, in that flexible metabolism, we stay somewhat metabolically fat adapted, or in other words, mm-hmm. we're able to use fat for fuel, and we're able to use it at a higher output. So, every human can, is capable to some extent burning fat for fuel, but if we're fat adapted, we can do that more effectively, and we can fuel our exercise training and competition at higher outputs, or in other words, higher efforts, higher percentage of maximum heart rate or functional threshold power, or whatever term that we're using. So that's really, I think, one of the keys is we want to be able to raise what they call in the exercise science literature, the fat max, the ability to get up to maybe 70 some percent of max output and still be primarily burning fat.
Interesting. Okay. That makes sense.
Reason for that is then we have a sparing effect, or less utilization or even wasting of our muscle glycogen, which is our stored sugar within the muscles and liver. The deal with that is, because we can only, as humans, depending on body size, store about 2,000 calories worth, we only really have enough onboard energy for, give or take, depending on effort, 2 hours of output. Mm-hmm. So even like a person who's like a very, glycolytic anaerobic team sport player, sometimes there are going to be practices that are going to last that long. And so it's not just for, say like kind of the endurance side of the equation. So by being more efficient and able to use fat for fuel at higher outputs, we spare that glycogen. And then again, ensure that it's available as jet fuel when we want to turn it on and have that power.
That's absolutely tracking with you 1-to-1 here, buddy.
Okay. So also, if we're flexible metabolically, in other words, that we haven't given up our ability to use carbs for fuel, we stay kind of finely tuned to get the most out of that. It's the body's not necessarily confused if carbs come in and like, I haven't done this in a while. It's going to take me a couple of weeks to upregulate these enzymes and things. No, you'll have that right away, which is very important in the athletic circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, it seems really intuitive when you're breaking it down here. It's there's no friction on the idea.
Right. Yeah. And I'm, sometimes, we talk about science meets common sense. We want to be appreciative of both. And I'm challenged at times to,
come on. No, you're not.
But, well,
no,
yeah.
You're not. I'm just saying it makes sense when you break it down like this for the non-scientific of those of us in the Gen Pop. So it really does seem important. I'm really want to, when we get a little further into it, but I know you have a couple more points on specifically for athletes, why it is important.
When you said break it down, all I could think of was you in some baggy sweatpants being MC Hammer. Just saying, man, I saw it.
I tell you, I mean, I don't know if I'm proud of it or not, but in eighth grade, I definitely had a pair of Hammer pants that were some of my favorite fits for the year. And it was not a good look here. You know, this is, again, Southwest Montana, eighth grade, whenever that was, circa undisclosed year.
You know, to flatter you as a lifetime athlete, you know, you got some massive quads. In fact, when you flex them, the gaps between the muscles are so great a small child could hide in them.
All right, that's ridiculous. Now we're losing credibility. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, some of the nuances about the importance for athletes in terms of that, the metabolic flexibility.
Yeah, so I was rambling before about how if we maintain some ability to utilize carbohydrate, we keep those systems optimal. And then also we can really improve or maintain how we restore muscle glycogen, and liver glycogen and recover. And there's quite a bit of literature out there and some anecdotal evidence and controversy. But the more a person does these anaerobic or glycolytic or, you know, high intensity training of reasonable volume with frequency that might even be back-to-back days in some cases, the more there's a potential benefit to having the carbohydrate in the diet. So, you know, again, some folks will argue, well, I mostly just do really, really a brief explosive, what are called alactic things in training. I don't really need much carbs. Yeah, that's true. Or you might say, well, I do a lot of LSD, as in long, slow distance work, you know, on the bike, the ski, the run. And it's all, you know, at a very aerobic level. You know, I don't really need carbs for that. There can be truth there as well. But the minute you start being diverse athletically, you know, the value of the carbohydrate comes up. And so that's where, you know, when you look at like the FASTER study, which is referenced a lot, that was Finney and Volek's work. And there's been, you know, quite a bit of spinoff from that. They really showed that performance does very well on essentially a ketogenic diet, but their population they were looking at was endurance athletes. And so we always have to be aware of, what are potential confounders in the research.
Sure. Well, another way to look at that is that if either one of those diets is working really well, then perhaps your training regimen isn't varied enough. I mean, that's what I really took away from that, is that if it really is, you know, if you're using the ketogenic and it really is just endurance athletes, then perhaps you're not mixing enough of the high intensity or the resistance training in to get the most out of your performances.
Right. And even the long-term health, of course, which
we
care about. And so ultimately this metabolically flexible metabolism allows us to preserve our health, and have stable energy levels. The reason being we're not locked into either side. We're relatively good at both. And so, you know, you'll hear people will say, when we look at the thyroid gland or the adrenal glands, you know, some other things that carbs may be helpful there. There's possibly some evidence to support that, although some of the newer stuff says it may just be electrolytes. And then also, excuse me, you know, the having that ability to use fat for fuel just keeps you feeling, you know, stable as far as energy, blood sugar levels through the day. And you're also able to do a lot of your training, without really worrying about having pre-workout meal or intra-workout feedings.
Yeah, and I feel like I've always been the most impressed by athletes that had that could perform outside of their discipline, you know. So whether that's a soccer player who is an excellent mountain biker, you know, and just does it in flats on a borrowed bike or something like that. And we're talking about the same quality in your metabolism, is that you, by employing this practice of metabolic flexibility, you have the ability to perform at a high level regardless of the kind of circumstances, because you're just a little bit hardier and can gain that fuel from different sources.
Yeah, precisely. You can kind of start looking at energy system utilization and different levels of things. Although when you go to skills, you know, that really wasn't true for Michael Jordan with baseball. But
wow, shots fired at the all-time great. I mean, wow.
Well, if we're talking about basketball, I'd agree.
That's true, but he's a good golfer. So I mean, you know, I think mm-hmm. that I think we can give the greatest. We can give MJ a pass on baseball. Yeah. All right, John. So let's shift gears and let's get a little deeper down and talk about specifically protein as a fuel source. What do we need? What sort of pen at the ready? What are the big points that I need to consider about protein?
Sure. Well, I would address this first, and I don't mean to be nitpicky or anything, but I would say, you know, protein as more of a building block than a fuel source. But I knew what you were saying. You know, it's just like as an ingested nutrient. so it's really a much maligned macro, and protein intake is safe for humans. It's critical. It's necessary. We have to have it. And you know, I think we're starting to see a change in that view, you know, driven by literature and then also adopted by the athletic world. We're actually leading the charge for the Gen Pop.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So if, you know, I recently did a cruise of PubMed, you know, just looking for recent studies and where this comes from. So, yeah, the recommendations are beginning to change regarding protein consumption for all humans. And, you know, so young, old, male, female, athletic, less athletic, although we want everybody to be athletic here. And really it's there were a few fears or theories, well, oh, let's have less protein. And those are not supported, not substantiated. And then there's a lot of stuff now that's saying, oh my, you know, we need this nutrient. So in a flexible metabolism, we're using fat and carbs for sort of like energy production. But for the athlete, we never want to we want to make sure that they're never not getting enough protein.
Interesting. So that's the thing that's just running consistently?
Yeah. And I'm trying to get big rockish, I guess, because you know, a lot of the literature uses grams of protein intake per kilogram of body weight or even kilograms of lean body mass. And I like those things. And there's some different levels of recommendation. But if you said it's too confusing, just give me the simple thing. It comes down to this: 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, you know, per day, per person. And so that's real easy to remember, you know, so I weigh 170 pounds. So every day I'm trying to eat between 150 and 190 grams of protein, give or take. And you know, that's quite a bit and it's almost a job.
Yeah. Like, can we put it into context, I guess, cause I'm imagining. So like, if we just talk about, and you may not know the answer to this, I'm kind of pulling this out of left field, but like we talk about like a chicken breast. How much, just a normal sized chicken breast, how many grams of protein would be in that?
Well, depending on the type of meat you're talking about, there are roughly, so we're talking about like, say, is it steak? Is it chicken breast? Is it fish? You know, different salmon, different than halibut? Sure. But, you know, you're looking at between roughly 7 to 9 grams of protein per ounce. Oh. And so if you're saying, well, you know, depending on, you know, how many hormones were injected into this chicken, how big's the breast, you know, if you got like a 6 ounce chicken breast, you know, you're getting, you know, probably 40 to 50 grams of protein in that serving.
Got it. So, I mean, that's a good, you know, imperfect, nice job on the sort of question out of left field, but I guess that really puts into context how much based on what you weigh, you know, how much protein, if you're getting it from meat or other sources, it really is, it's probably more if you're not tracking it. It's kind of my point, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And so I want to, you know, recommend tracking. And also, if you use the chicken breast example, most people, you know, they need to eat 3 of those a day, which is like, oh man, I don't know. Depends on how it's prepared, whether that seems that palatable to me. So I like to mix it up. But kind of getting into that a little more. So when we look at this 1 gram per pound of body weight, yeah, it's a range. And so a person who is, let's say, you know, on the light side of athletic, might be able to get away with a tiny bit less, although not much. Mm-hmm. And then we start to say, well, what about endurance athletes? They actually benefit from having, you know, that 1 gram or even a little bit more because of tissue repair. So, you know, endurance athletics, they're not really trying to build lots of muscles, but they're chronically breaking it down. And so they just got to get back to baseline. And that's one of the reasons why you see, you know, things like chronic fatigue, stress fractures, other problems in the endurance athlete population, because, you know, protein intake is one of the factors, not the only one.
Wow. That's interesting. I mean, excuse me, you may have mentioned that, but that's a pretty big point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's astounding almost that now we have so much literature to support the value of just simply eating more protein. And then when we look at strength athletes, you know, and so most people in their minds are going to say, oh, well, that's a weightlifter, a power lifter, a bodybuilder, a lineman, you know, whatever it is, it's not just that, but, they require even a bit more protein, at least the 1 gram, if not a little bit more. And mm-hmm. also they need to have a caloric surplus, which stimulates that anabolic side of the equation so that they can, you know, make the gains, bro.
Yeah, that absolutely tracks. And I do feel like if you're on that sort of, if that's your athletic pursuit, your performance you're shooting for, then connecting the protein to the strength training is there. What about some of the, you know, like considerations for those of us that, you know, maybe looking at, you know, depending on our age, or if maybe we're thinking more about weight loss in anticipation of an athletic pursuit in regard to protein?
Sure. Well, based on research, weight loss seems to work best. And in other words, preserving health and sparing muscle mass when, a person in the presence of a caloric deficit eats a high amount of protein. So really it's like, this would make sense. You know, I mean, we're not trying to focus on the energy macronutrients as much. We just don't want to lose the body, you know, the body can, in, you know, cases of starvation or inappropriate nutrition, you know, it can, you know, strip protein from the muscles and the bones just to, you know, keep the organs alive, but unfortunately there's negative repercussions to doing that.
Right. Okay. That absolutely makes sense.
All which can be avoided by what we do in the kitchen. And then the older athlete, that's an interesting thing. So, you know, if you go through this, okay, we're roughly at 1 gram, but who's going to have a bit more? Well, we're like, okay, well, maybe the endurance athletes go up a tenth, you know, and then the strength athletes, maybe they'll go up another one or two. Well, the weight loss people, you know, again, we need to keep the calories low for weight loss, of course, but they need even a little bit more protein to prevent the muscle mass loss. And then lastly, older athletes need the most amount of protein.
John, that idea or that practice is just not out there in the world.
No, and we've talked before about age-related sarcopenia, which is a loss of muscle mass as we age, and it's strongly correlated to loss of function and also death. And when people get older, a lot of times, you know, maybe they don't have the appetite, they're eating more, you know, kind of processed food, they're not cooking as much, there's all of this, and it's actually the very wrong time to do such a thing. Here are the reasons, scientifically or biologically. As we get older, humans, we tend to produce less stomach acid overall, and stomach acid's what helps us to digest and break down protein. Mm-hmm. The acid that we do produce is slightly less acidic, and so, you know, we need to have more protein coming in to offset that. The efficiency with which we break down those peptides and take up the amino acids goes down. So not only do we have the stomach acid issue, we've got just kind of a slowdown of cellular efficiency in protein synthesis within the body. And this last thing, which is really, it's just new research that we've seen over the last few years, anabolic resistance. And so an older muscle fiber is just more resistant, more reluctant, shall we say, to build strength and mass. And I think we all know this and see it. Well, the trick is that each protein serving should be a minimum of about 30 grams, as you indicated. You know, you need to have something a little bigger than that deck of cards idea that used to be out there. That's not adequate. And also, it has to have about 3 grams of the amino acid, one of the essential amino acids, leucine, to trigger muscle protein synthesis. So, you know, particularly if we're talking about these older athletes, we got to make sure that they're eating a nice bolus of high quality protein a couple times a day.
Wow. So you're saying, and that's each in the serving, if you have just 20 grams, let's say, with under 3 grams of leucine, you're not going to trigger that synthesis?
That seems to be what the literature reports. You know, 30 is sort of a ballpark because, you know, some of the studies would say it's 27, 28 grams, you know, and the same thing with the leucine at 3 grams. Some of the research will say it's 2.7. But, you know, if you're, you know, this time of year, if anybody's doing their taxes, you know, the IRS wants you to round up anyway. So that's what you do with your
protein. Got it. Yeah, and that's interesting. John, that's kind of revelatory information, depending on where you may be at. You've really just listed 4 significantly different, maybe, I guess, avatars for people out in the world that may be in the audience, from endurance athletes, strength, folks that are maybe focused on weight loss, and then older athletes, but they're all benefiting from protein as that sort of foundational base.
Yes. And then we get into some of the concerns. You know, I won't get too long-winded here, but, you know, when we look at kidney health, you know, there's been kind of a convention based on opinion that, oh, well, you know, protein wrecks your kidneys. And that's really not true. Yes, on a high protein diet, the kidney is an organ. It will get bigger and stronger. And then GFR, glomerular filtration rate, and BUN, blood urea nitrogen, will go up. But that's because these stronger kidneys are more efficient at processing the nitrogen byproduct of protein metabolism. But really, with the marker, and you should consult with your healthcare provider on this, you know, it's creatinine. And I like to remind people that's not creatine, the supplement. This is creatinine, which is, you know, it's a breakdown product and it's evidenced of kidney disease. So the only time, in a healthy person, a high protein diet's not bad for their kidneys. But a person with pre-existing kidney disease might not want to be on a high protein diet because the kidneys don't have the abilities that they normally would.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. That's, again, grounded in common sense.
Then you've got the whole cancer and longevity camp. Those sort of overlap a bit. And, you know, the idea there was that, you know, excess protein intake is going to overstimulate mTOR, or the mechanistic target of rapamycin, and, you know, basically keep us anabolic all the time and not have some of the benefits of the catabolic swing that we need to do through some of the day. And again, that's been essentially disproven, in that mTOR response varies throughout the body. The muscles aren't the same, let's say, as some of the organs and so forth. And so in a well-constructed diet where a person is eating, you know, let's say not constantly through the day, but, you know, a few meals, and again, these macros are sort of balanced, which we'll get into. No defined risk or concern, almost the opposite. Again, you know, where people who don't eat the protein are at more risk of wasting away, or cachexic states, when you're referring to cancer patients.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes. So animal sources rule, you know, as far as the quality, the bioavailability, the ability of the meat or fish or eggs to have the right amino acid profile and enough of the essential ones, like, and particularly the leucine and all that, to make this happen. They're just more absorbable, more bioavailable within the body. Now, that being said, some people don't prefer to consume those things. And so respectfully, I would say, yeah, if you're a vegan, you can do it, but you have to do it supplementally. It's virtually impossible to eat an entirely plant-based diet and get all the protein you need just from eating, like, say, broccoli or rice or whatever, the protein content and also quality of that stuff is so low, you'd literally have to eat wheelbarrowfuls of it per day just to get your protein requirement, which would have all sorts of other ramifications. So by supplements, what I mean is, then you have to use plant-based protein powder. It's just, you know, it's a given. If you're a vegan and you want enough protein for these optimal health, longevity, and performance things, then, you know, soy, rice, hemp, pea, and other kinds of, you know, proteins like that really need to become a staple in your diet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point. It also just, you know, that's the reality of, that's the constraints of the human body. And if you choose to, employ that practice with your nutrition, then you just have some other considerations to work in if you don't want to suffer from a lack of protein.
Yeah. And just summing this up, you know, in, when you're eating your protein meal in a mixed meal, in other words, you know, you have your chicken breasts and your broccoli and rice or your steak and your potato or whatever it is, have a few bites of protein first. And what that'll do is that'll improve your overall glucose response to the meal and improve your satiety because that protein gets in there and does those things. So it's just kind of a little trick for anyone that, wants to either, watch out for how much they eat and weight gain, or also just, feel better. That's a great way to approach your plate.
Wow. Okay. I like it. Anything else as we wrap protein up before we turn the corner to talk about carbs?
Yeah. Last thing is it takes multiple meals to hit your bolus target. So in other words, if you said to me, I'll just use myself as an example, you're going to go on kind of an intermittent fasting or time restricted feeding protocol, which is the OMAD or one meal a day model, which can be very helpful for a person, again, digging out of a health hole or an illness hole, shall we say. But for a hard training athlete, that I don't think that gives me enough fuel availability. And also, that means I've got to eat a steak the size of John Candy in The Great Outdoors, the old 96er. So even if I like steak, which I love it, it sounds miserable. So again, like for different populations or different cases, I would advocate not eating 2 to 4 meals per day. But for the hard training, healthy athlete, I'm absolutely suggesting eat 2 to 4 meals per day. And then that way, like PKs, like The Rock, if he's eating chicken breasts, he can eat 4 a day.
Yeah, right. Get out of here. However, if you are splitting it out for 4 a day, you do want to get that 30 grams minimum to make sure that we get this, we want to trigger that stuff that we need to trigger. Correct.
Yeah. And so there, some people are like, oh man, awesome. I love it that you said that. Now I can just have more of this. But a lot of people, there are a lot of people that they're going to resist that for numbers of reasons. So we want to kindly encourage them to give these facts, not opinions, some consideration.
Absolutely. I mean, just laid it out there. You can go ahead and, take it as you will, audience. Let's shift gears. Let's talk about carbs. Where do we start this conversation? Because it could be maybe not controversial, but just the waters are muddy.
Yeah, it's like a carb conundrum almost. So, carbs, they're just a macro. So they're not sinister, there are camps that say, well, just carbs are just totally evil and nobody should ever eat carbs. Mm-hmm. The reason where a lot of that comes from is because we're modern humans and we have all these inexpensive, hyper-palatable processed carbs that cause the problem. So, a carb is a carb. That's not entirely true. Most of your carbs are coming from, fruits and vegetables and things like that. That's a different metabolic picture than when it's, flours and starches and sugars.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Now that makes sense, but I think it's worth really hitting that home that there are differences there.
Sure. And for the athlete, I think we're spinning out of this, but for numbers of decades, probably starting up in the 70s, it was thought, well, if a little carb is good, then more's got to be better. And so we just go on this carbo loading, carbo packing, high carb diet type of approach, which again, metabolically, isn't the healthiest for us. And, you know, if you do that for enough decades, it usually wrecks the metabolism. So I am advocating for athletes to use some carbs, but I'm not advocating to just go crazy. You know, that's not going to get you what you want.
Right. No, it isn't. So what else were we thinking about here?
Well, timing kind of matters, particularly with carbohydrate. You know, that there's some reason to consider, like say pre-event or pre-workout fueling in some cases, intra-session fueling, and then post, you know, so I'll touch on those very briefly. Sure. A pre-workout meal, you know, just depends on the timing of when one has that. You probably want to have a mixed macro meal that's easily digestible. Oh, you know, 400, 600 calories, hour and a half out. Again, that's going to vary, but we have to be careful that we time it right, so you don't get what's called reactive hypoglycemia. So if you eat too much carbs too far out, your body's going to produce insulin and it's going to vacuum up all that blood sugar. And then you're going to start your event, you know, hypoglycemic, feeling kind of lousy. So, you know, we just got to make sure, you know, you experiment with that. Then if you're looking at still the pre idea, if you have something that's like a straight carb source, like, you know, like a commercial product, although I don't love processed food, half a banana, you know, just as you're starting, you can kind of bypass that because that will, you know, rapidly get into the bloodstream. And then the exercising muscles using the GLUT4 transporters will take it up. So you don't really have that same residence time in the bloodstream that you would otherwise. It's kind of cool to know. Yeah. The other thing is in long sessions, longer, you know, sessions, hour and a half plus, you know, and if you're going moderately hard, trickling in some carbs during is a great way to do it. It's, you know, it's kind of like a nice way to spare that glycogen and the body will use it. You know, we've got athletes doing that in lots of circumstances. And then the post deal, it's like, yeah, you know, there's some argument back and forth on this, but, there does seem to be an advantage in with carbohydrate intake with muscle glycogen resynthesis if it's not too long after exercise. And so, again, everybody's going to be a bit different. The one thing I would say, though, is we all have to take a look at ourselves and honestly say that, you know, you really need to be training a lot before you need much carbohydrate in that sequence I just put out there. And, you know, unless you're really getting after it, just you don't need to eat anything.
Right. And I think that's might be a bit more of a psychological wrinkle. You know, we're training hard, even if it's not that long, you know, we think that we do to fuel it. Like you're saying, really, really break it down beyond what you think. And how would you sort of suggest exploring to find out whether you need that or not?
Yeah, I mean, the body will speak to it. Again, if you're metabolically flexible and not necessarily carbohydrate dependent, you can go out for, you know, a 45, 60 minute jog, run, don't need anything, you know, no problem. 60, 90 minutes on the bike, you know, a tough hour in the gym, you don't need anything before, during. Then after, sure, maybe have something. But where you see, you know, people get kind of caught up in this with all the marketing and, you know, the dollars that drive this. It's like, well, I'm going to have like a couple bars and a couple gels. I'm going to strap on a couple syrups and, you know, carry all this stuff. And it's like, it's just silly.
It's silly, but I think that, that's interesting. Talk to me about the source of the carb. Why that does matter, but why?
Well, most of the time in the normal diet, I would say, you know, we want those, you know, those fruits and vegetables, different types, of course, but they're mostly, you know, mostly complex carbohydrates. So they tend to break down a little slower. You know, carbs turn to sugar, no matter what it is, you know, but the glycemic index of some of those things is lower. In other words, the amount of spiking we get, that varies within each person, and also the glycemic load, how long it stays elevated. So we want to eat things that, you know, are just kinder to our metabolisms, with the one exception being the simple carbs, again, you know, right around the exercise, either immediately before, during, or after. You know, you almost want them in those circumstances because we get rapid absorption and we also don't have digestive load. So again, it's common sense.
Absolutely. Okay. Makes sense.
So I just say experiment, but with carbs, you just have to watch that slippery slope because they, you know, they're addictive. I mean, I love them and I spent a lot of years eating too many of them. And I was told, oh, well, if you're an athlete, you know, fire's hot, just throw anything in there, it burns. And no, you know, you can't out-train a bad diet. And it eventually caught me, bit me in the ass. And, you know, I don't want that for anybody else. So, you know, I'm speaking here from, you know, a point of concern, a point of experience, and also of study. And so that's all I would say is use some carbs, but don't start convincing yourself that you need unlimited amounts.
Yeah, I would say that it's almost like if you're really excited about this, if it seems too good to be true, like, you know, the fire's hot, just, you know, it can burn through whatever, then it probably is. But you've laid out kind of a certainly the logic and the back by science, you know, methodology. What if someone's saying, okay, this is interesting, John, you're hitting home on a lot of levels here. How do I put this together?
Okay. So what we want to do is every time we talk about food, we always say we want you to eat the planet-based diet. So eat food that looks like it came from Mother Earth. And, you know, it's a whole fresh, local, seasonal, natural food. So it's, you know, it's fruits and vegetables, it's meat, it's eggs, it's fish. It's that kind of thing. It's not wrapped in Mylar packages and ground and pressed and so forth. And so that's really what the planet-based diet is. We got to do that as our platform. And, you know, when you do that, you're 80% there.
Absolutely. Okay. So we've got the planet-based diet as the foundation. What are the other wrinkles that we want to work into our plan?
Respecting the chronobiology or chrononutritional research that's blown up in the last couple of years, I'm going to say eat when the sky is light, whenever you can. You know, obviously, and certainly in some team sports capacities or after work type things. If you train late, you know, there's probably a lot of reason to eat after training. But if that's not the case, you know, eat when the sky is light. And, you know, for an athlete, we're not trying to compress their eating window too much, but you know, if you can get it down to 10 or 12 hours that you're consuming food and then have the other side of that be when you're not obviously sleeping and fasting, that's good for health.
Absolutely. Okay. Got it.
For the athlete, use 2 to 4 meals. Again, you've got to get, we've got to get the total number of calories in. We need that protein requirement. And then also, you know, just again, with the fuels, and maybe right along with that, I would say just always keep protein consistent. There's no need to most days, you know, go too low or too high on your protein. Stay close to your target, and also to that bolus plus requirement for each meal.
Got it. John, this is a question that popped into my mind. I don't want to throw us off topic, but if you're not getting the protein, like let's say you're not getting enough, what is there something that's going to feel like that would be an indication if you're not tracking it?
Yeah. I think there can be numbers of things. You know, one of the first things is recovery from exercise tends to slow down. Mm-hmm. A person will feel tired and achy. Muscle soreness will be slower to go away because of that repair mechanism that the muscles use. And then, you know, bad things can start happening too. Nails get brittle and break, hair starts to fall out, you know, teeth start to have some problems. So a chronic low protein individual will suffer from those things and others.
Okay. Interesting. I think that's a good one with the recovery taking longer. All right. Talk to me what else we're doing with putting it all together.
Well, this is pretty much the take home message. Okay. And it's in order to stay metabolically flexible and also to be able to use the macros most appropriately, our early meals. So if you eat 4 meals a day, that would be the first 2. If you only eat 2, it's only the first one. The early meal needs to be high fat, low carb, probably at a macro percentage of about 50% fat, 40% protein, never changing, 10% carb. So that's a low carb or almost ketogenic type of a meal first thing in the day, whether one eats at 8 a.m. or 11 a.m.
Got it. Okay. That's making sense.
Yeah. And the reason is because that minimizes elevation of insulin. It extends some of the kind of, you know, to some extent, the fasting autophagy processes that we got through the night. Obviously, when we eat, that does, you know, change. But we want that, and it helps us stay stable through the day, and it keeps us able to burn the fat.
Mm, okay, that makes sense.
Then we totally flip-flop it. So the PM meals, again, whether that's one or two, are low-fat, high-carb in the metabolic flexibility model. And so by that, what we would mean would be, okay, now we're taking fat down about 10% of total calories. Protein stays at 40. And we're enjoying about 50% of total calories on the plate as healthy carbs.
Wow. Okay. That seems to make sense. So what's that? What benefits do we get from doing the switcheroo?
That's when we get that replenishment, augmentation of the replenishment of muscle glycogen. So, you know, the carbs, the muscles are refilling and refueling. And again, for the athlete, sometimes, the athlete wants or needs to hit another significant training session in a day or two. And that's where this comes in.
Interesting. Okay.
So lastly, I just say, you know, these prefixes, iso, hyper, hypo. So, you know, if you're going to be isocaloric most of the time, that's what we want for the athlete going through training cycles. You know, you have to eat enough calories that you're not losing weight and maybe not gaining significant amounts of weights if that's not the goal. So you know, you can use the tracker. I like to recommend Chronometer. They have a free version, chronometer.com. And it's just great to track for a few weeks. You know, you can't guess, you know, you don't know till you know. And so suddenly, you know, you can become a real expert at like, well, how many, like you asked me earlier, you know, how many grams of protein are in this and, you know, whatever, what am I eating? How many calories per day? You know, you don't have to do it forever. And I'm certainly the personality type that, you know, I like to preform a little bit too much sometimes, but for anyone, it's a great tool. If you're trying to stay hypercaloric because you're trying to gain weight, and we want most of that to be muscle mass, of course, you know, maintain a caloric surplus. If you're trying to be hypo, to lose weight, that's great, but you probably only want to stay hypocaloric a couple hundred calories under your ISO baseline, 3 to 6 days before you have a day where you do a refeed. I don't really use the term cheat day. I don't like that term, but you know, you just eat, you know, if you have to have a little junk food, go ahead, but mostly just eat more healthy food. What that does, it prevents metabolic slowdown. So if you stay kind of semi-starvation long enough, you're going to get, you know, tired and sleepy and start to get some wasting things going on. And so this sort of prevents it.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So just following up with that, I would say just to finish up here, some other resources and suggestions. Well, I put out a two-part blog this week on metabolic flexibility for athletes, part one and two. You can find it on thelifetimeathlete.com. Kind of goes over in greater detail some of the things that we discussed. It also has a sample meal plan. You know, just kind of, you know, an idea of what would a day of eating look like for an omnivore, a carnivorous person, or a vegan using this methodology. So that's there. That. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes it's good to see it in, you know, in table form. Also, if you're really interested in, say, this topic about, you know, metabolic flexibility, athletic nutrition recovery, how do we tweak the levers in the kitchen to get peak performance? Consider coming to the Hard to Kill workshop, which is coming up rapidly here this Saturday, February 29th in Bozeman, Montana. And you can go to thelifetimeathlete.com and click on the Hard to Kill menu item at the top, get lots of information about what's going to happen in addition to what we talked about today. And there's also a button to register. So I'd highly recommend it, of course, but I think it really is valuable for somebody who's, you know, getting ready to launch into spring and really wants to kick ass.
No question. Any other, as we wrap it up here, what if someone's saying, I want some one-on-one Jay-Z time?
That sounds fun. There's probably like a Barry White song in there, but I'm not going to try that. If you just move over on the menu one item, there's coaching and you can click on that. And, you know, I offer coaching relationships with folks to do these very things, you know, kind of tweak not just the training, but what we're doing here nutritionally, as well as consulting on injuries and solving those kinds of problems and also tuning up body comp. So yeah, that you can get that, and I'm happy to work with you should that be your interest. And maybe lastly, what I would say today is feel free to share with us on this topic. Leave a comment, a question, and I'll get back to you. Share your results with in doing this or other dietary things so that we can use that. And if you really, really are brave, come on the show. We'll make you feel good and we'll have some fun.
Absolutely. Well, John, this was a very wellness pearl rich episode, I feel like.
It was fun for me. So thanks to you, PK. And hey, everybody, thanks for joining us. Hey, happy training.